You are tuned in to Community Radio, listener-supported KGNU. I'm Maeve Conran, and up next, it's time for our Radio Book Club, a monthly collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. My co-host, as always, Arsene Kashkashian, for the first time not joining me in the studio because of the current situation, and I believe it's the first time we've not had an author join us in the studio, but we are all together on a Zoom call. Well, Arsene, who have we been reading along for the month of April? It's actually a returning author to the book club.
Yeah, we're going to be reading, we read Beheld by Tara Shay Nesbitt, and Tara Shay was one of the very first authors we had on the show 5 years ago. I think she was the second or third author we had. And this is a wonderful historical novel that takes place in 1630 in Plymouth Colony in Massachusetts. And I can't wait to dive into it with Tara Shay.
Well, we are delighted to have Tara Shay Nesbitt joining us on this Zoom call. Welcome to the Radio Book Club. And the first book that you were actually featured on way back, I think it was about 5 years ago, The Wives of Los Alamos, your first novel, that was similar to your latest one, Beheld, insofar as it's written from the perspective of women during a time in the US history when the women have often been removed and written out of the history book. So give us a sense of why this was something you wanted to look into and what's behind Beheld.
So I was living in Boulder. I was getting a PhD at the University of Denver, and I was finishing up my coursework. I just submitted the final copy edits for The Wives of Los Alamos. And I was kind of looking for a story from a lesser heard perspective in American history, but really casually. I didn't want to push anything. And I didn't even want to take this course. Sorry, it was a good course, but in the moment I didn't want to take it because I thought early American history is really boring. It turns out it is so not boring. It is one of the most fascinating periods because it sets the stage for the contemporary moment and the future and how the arrival of the Mayflower passengers had the effect that they had on the Northeastern woodlands and the rest of the world, of the rest of the country. So I'm in this class and I'm reading William Bradford's Of Plymouth Plantation. And in class, I turn the page and William Bradford, if you don't know him, he is the longstanding governor of Plymouth. So it's his book Of Plymouth Plantation that tells us who the Mayflower passengers were, which at one point he refers to them as the Pilgrims. And that's what we call them, the Pilgrims, but he didn't really refer to himself as the Pilgrims throughout. But anyway, nevertheless, at one point he highlights all of the deaths that happened that first winter and all of the struggle that they went through. And then he casually says, and William Bradford's wife perished that on the ship or something like that. And there's no mention beyond that what happened to her. And this was so striking to me that his own wife in this big book that tells the story of so many people and how they passed away and how they persevered, that he doesn't talk about how his own wife died. And I was pursuing that mystery immediately. As soon as I saw that, I knew that there was something there. And I didn't want to initially write the novel actually because of how much research I knew I would have to do. I didn't know, you know, the worldviews were different, but the sense of like how science was working within also religious philosophy, how the language was so odd, if they had forks, there were just all these details that I didn't know, but she wouldn't go away. And so I wrote from the perspective of William Bradford's first wife, Dorothy, for quite a while. And that was the complete first draft. And I can speak more. I don't want to be too verbose from the start off question, but it was a long journey from that moment at the University of Denver with this mystery of why this woman died to flash forward 6 years later. And I'm speaking to you right now and I'm telling the story of the first murder trial that happens 10 years after they land.
Dorothy ends up being, she's a character in the book, but her voice is not in the book. We get a lot of the voice. The biggest voice in the book is actually Bradford's second wife. And maybe you can tell us about how did you transition to Dorothy being who you're going to tell the story from to moving the story 10 years later to 1630, and Bradford's second wife, Alice, becoming the major narrator.
Yes. So, you know, I was like, why did Tippismia not mention how his wife died? And through a bunch of research, I learned that, you know, I thought, if he's leaving this out, what else is he leaving out? And it turns out he was leaving out a lot. And that the story that I thought I knew about the Mayflower passengers seeking religious freedom, all of that was, I will say, stretching the truth. And so in that research, I discovered the story of the first murder trial, and a key figure in that murder trial was also on the Mayflower. And there were only a few women that survived the Mayflower journey. So though Dorothy survived, or Dorothy died, only a few were left that were living. So that's a long way of saying the second voice I came to wasn't actually Alice, it was the voice of Eleanor Billington, this newly freed indentured servant who wants to set the story straight. She's angry and fed up that the people that are in the positions of power are telling a story to help themselves and not recognizing all the factions that were within the community. And then after I wrote her, I started to see how an underlying story needed to occur with Alice Bradford, the second wife. And I can't really explain how that happened exactly, except as I was writing Eleanor, this more like formal, proper politician's wife voice came to me. And I thought, she's going to tell the story as her husband would like her to tell it. But in the middle, she breaks from that story and she ends up telling a story about friendship and about girlhood and about grief, her longing for her friend, which is Dorothy Bradford, the first wife. So I came to her with the thought that she would be aligned with her husband and maybe Dorothy would sneak in somehow. But then she took on a life of her own and started to tell another story. But Dorothy and Alice in real life did know one another, and the three of them were all living in Holland together, and they had they could practice their religion. And so they leave and come to the Northeastern Woodlands. And Alice was on the ship initially, and then she steps off. And that was fascinating to me because then William Bradford marries her after his first wife dies. And so it all kind of weaved back and forth to tell this other story.
I was so fascinated by Eleanor, one of the women whose perspective we're hearing in the book, because she's so honest. It's almost like she's the Greek chorus, and she calls out the hypocrisy that is in the colony that really has become the official history of the colony. But she calls them hypocrites to their face, which I can imagine was an incredible thing to actually do. But she was an indentured servant who then worked her way out of servitude, one of several in the colony. But who were they? What was their history? How did they end up there?
Yes. So they're on the... So taking you back to this ship, before that, you have people who were in Holland who say, like, we don't want our kids to become too Dutch. Our children are intermarrying. There's this sense that another war might happen with the Spanish. We want to be English. We still want to be English. And in order to do that, we need to find a place to have an English colony, which is a different history than I had heard. So they weren't fleeing religious persecution. And so they, in order to do that, a lot of economic configuring happens. And there are multiple points in which they are trying to find different places to go. And then finally, they're offered to a free ride to New Amsterdam. And they say no, because then if we do that, we'll still be among the Dutch. So you have to think about American history, especially the Plymouth colony, as having an origin partly of xenophobia, of wanting to separate and isolate. So unfortunately for them, but I think fortunately for the contemporary moment, they did not get what they wanted because they did not have enough passengers and enough money to get themselves alone into the Northeastern Woodlands. And so they had to negotiate with Thomas Weston and other kind of like people that are working with the banks in England to help support and fund the journey. Okay, and then their ship, the Speedwell, leaks, has problems, and so they have to combine with these adventurers and their planned indentured servants, which they didn't want to do, and so that gets them over. So the indentured servants, a lot of them were coming from England because the ship from Holland comes to England, picks up more people, and then the two ships head over. But some of them were just adventurers. They just wanted to get a trip over. Maybe they were going to work in the fur trade. They were going to try their hand at the trading post. The indentured servants, I think, were about 20% of the people on the ship. And they ranged from the youngest was 4 years old. It was a four-year-old boy that was an indentured servant. And he was of a family of four children that were on board that were sent away by their father without their mother's knowledge because their father, it was rumored that the children were, their children's really real father was the neighbor and not the father. And the father wanted to rise in politics. And so he gets rid of the kids so he could gain politics. Hey, so you have that, a four-year-old boy, indentured servant, all the way to an adult male. And they would sign up for 7 years, sometimes against their will, as in the four-year-old. He didn't want to sign up for 7 years, but 7 years of working the land or working for a master. And then that master would agree to like give them freedom. And in the space of Plymouth, it would mean that you would have a parcel of land that you could then build your home on and have your animals on in your garden and such like that. And then it changed over time, who was considered indentured servitude and who was able to be considered indentured and all of that.
Well, it seems that even after they served their time, they still weren't full members of society because there were those deep divisions that, of course, we still have today between the haves and the have-nots, and so much effort by the haves to keep the have-nots down in society.
And part of the separation, yes, that's exactly right. And part of the separation was also a religious difference. So it corresponded that the indentured servants and a few other people that were within the colony were not separatist Puritans. So they didn't believe, you know, the separatist Puritans, the ones coming from Holland, believed we cannot reform the church. We have to completely separate in order to have a place in God's honor. And the Anglicans had a different view of things. And so when they get to Plymouth, for one, they could never hold a minister. They couldn't keep a preacher. And their own preacher didn't even come with them from Holland. But then they had a lot of lay preachers. But when they did get a minister, in two cases, they sent them back to, they kicked them out of the colony. Once, because Pastor Lyford was, he was baptizing in the Anglican way for the Anglicans, if they also needed it. And another time, because Roger Williams was questioning how they owned land and didn't they owe the Indians. So yes, the sense of haves and have-nots, the economic inequality and how that particularly was being tied to what one believed in terms of their religion was always in existence.
We're speaking with author Tarashe Nesbitt on the Radio Book Club here at KGNU. Her latest novel is Beheld, as we're hearing it set in the Plymouth colony, but this is from the perspective of women, specifically two women. And my co-host, as always, is Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore.
So, you know, talking about perspective, one of the things I thought was interesting is the two main women who are narrating are Eleanor Billington, who's one of these indentured servants, her husband's John Billington, and also Alice Bradford. And when you're in their heads, when you're narrating through them, you're using the first person, the I. But you do have some male characters that tell part of the story, and those chapters are third person. You know, so whether it's John Billington or the newcomer who comes in to the colony. So tell us a little bit about that. So you're right in the head, you're right with the women, But from a man, you're always kind of at a little distance.
Yes. So many of the stories from history that we hear are from the perspective of men. And where I wanted to put the most agency and the most sense of intimacy, and I want you to understand, is from the perspective of the women. And so I chose I for them. But I wasn't even really conscious of it. I just knew in order to get close to Eleanor and Alice, I need to be an I. They need to speak as an I. And then when I looked, and I did try doing Billington and Newcomen in first person, I thought, this is too close. Like, this isn't their story. This isn't their show. They're existing, and it's important to hear their perspective, particularly when given what unfolds that day. But I felt like there's an overstory of the first murder of a colonist in Plymouth. And then there is this understory, which is the story of women living in Plymouth and what it can tell us about America now, or what can it can tell us about shifts in power, or just, you know, what it is to be a woman within that space.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I enjoyed it, and I thought it was very interesting to see that. And the one thing, Alice is very interesting because so much of her tale is her memory and going back to her life with Dorothy as a girl and as a young woman. And so much of the story, because you come to this land which has nothing really for the colonists to begin with, but they're constantly living in their heads to some extent. I thought it was very interesting how Alice spends a lot of time really thinking about what life was like previously and grieving for that.
Mm-hmm. I thought
that was an interesting one.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I did imagine her as feeling a bit isolated because of her role as the governor's wife, in the way that she has certain things she has to do and perform. And so she can't have a certain kind of intimacy with some of the women because of where she is within the society. But I also think it seemed right to me that that she would have this kind of survivor's guilt that she had left her friend on that dock, which she had left her friend on the dock in Plymouth, England, and not gone on the Mayflower, and wondering still what would have happened. And I think because she's narrating it at the end of her life, she's asking herself, she's looking back on those moments that had such importance. But I also think that she intends to tell a different story. And then she, what really emerges for her is this story of girlhood.
You're listening to the Radio Book Club on Community Radio KGNU. It is a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran. My co-host, as always, Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. And joining us, we have Tarashe Nesbitt speaking about her new novel, Beheld.
So, Tarashe, you have these two different voices, and we're going to hear you read some of Eleanor Billington, who is the former indentured servant, who has a much more kind of direct voice. So let's hear some of her passage.
I'm leaving my house, right? John and our son already out in the field. I'm getting the logs as one doth, minding my own, when those three steely faces turn to me. Oh, their chaste little bosoms, their pious little smiles. Women who think they are better than I, than us, the servants. But we weren't their servants, nay, not any longer. 1 year out of indentured servitude, but watching them look at me, you'd never know it. I took enough of those glances in London, I shan't be needing them now, mistresses, I yelled across the garden. Alice, the governor's wife, covered her chest. Susanna put her hand on her hip. Elizabeth went back to her weed-pulling. Revelry it was to rile them. Sing for your supper, that is what my mum did. Staying for her bloody supper, and I did what I had to do, did I not, to pay Weston for this journey? Given how we lived on the Mayflower, on the wet ship floor with the rats nibbling our toes, he should have paid us. When my feet first fell upon this land, I had in mind to return to the ship's master and say, take me back. This is not what I purchased. We agreed to 7 years of labor with respectable, ordinary English people. We agreed to 7 years of servitude in Virginia, not Plymouth. But oh, no, no, William Bradford had an answer. My kind, my common kind, we are never given what we are promised.
You know, listening to you read that in the voice of Eleanor, it just strikes me, it's so incredible how not very much has changed, you know, 400 odd years later, in terms of inequality. It's still so embedded in society. You know, was that something that struck you when you were doing your research? You know, how little progress it seems that we've actually made, you know, when it comes to human relations, our treatment of Indigenous people, inequality that we still see today?
Yes. I was very surprised, though I shouldn't have been, that there were indentured servants on the ship and that there were certain levels of inequality. I don't know why I was surprised. I didn't know. I did a bunch of research about indentured servitude in the United States, and I think I know I'm attuned to it in a particular way because I grew up in a spot. I grew up in a lower income apartment complex that was, you know, cockroach infested most of the warm seasons. And then when I was just about to start junior high, both of my parents, who were separated, got enough economic stability to move to the other side of town, the east versus the west. And we moved to the west side of town, and that's where the kids' parents were, like, running the symphony, and there were doctors, and there was this, and there was that. And so I had moved from, like, the factory working, customer service, family spaces, into this other space, and it seemed to me that both perspectives did not have a full understanding of one another. And so in the one, with the increase of wealth, I was definitely aware of how I was outside of that space, though able to work within. And so it's constantly on my mind at all levels. And then of course, right now, the way that we are seeing it most terribly is the sense that those of us that can isolate or can socially distance have a certain kind of stability that others of us can't. And that troubles me very deeply. And I keep writing into it, how can we form communities? How can we be communities of care? How can we recognize inequality and work to create more stability for all? I keep writing into it, not from a place of look how terrible this is, but from a place of, if I keep writing it, maybe I'll find a solution. It's actually this really hopeful place of wanting to imagine a world in which at least when we name it, we know it exists. And then from there, we can try to move forward.
Yeah, but I think in your story, the pilgrims certainly don't move towards equality. Like they're very, very invested, Bradford and Miles Standish. We haven't talked to, you do such a wonderful job with his character. You know, they're very much into enforcing that status quo to their advantage. And I thought, and kind of viciously at times too.
Yeah, I think a lot of us are working with our own self-interest, and I'm not immune from that, but in ways that even our own self-interest work against, we make decisions that aren't good for ourselves or for others. And that was there. And I, you know, I didn't know that Miles Standish was the one hired soldier that they hired in Holland to help them fight. He taught them how to use guns before they left Holland. They arrive and he very quickly is setting up a palisade. They take the bodies that are dying and they put them outside. They put them against trees, prop them up against trees so that it looks like a forest sentinel, because that's how terrified they were with a sense of what threat was out there, right? The Native American communities, which were many Native American communities. And he commits the first murder. This isn't a spoiler. He commits the first murder. He takes some of the Puritan, the pilgrims, Puritans, and they go to Wessagusset, And there's a lot of conflicting information about what happens that day. But one thing that happens is that under Miles Standish's lead, they kill 4 to 7 men and at least one boy. They're Massachusetts men and of other nations. And the reasons of for why are either one man taunts him or one man called him short, depending on who you talk to. And so there was real, and then he comes back and he's proudly carrying the head of one of the men with vomit and puts it on a pike above the meeting house. And there's a flag with Wituwamish blood that waves. And to imagine that as Plymouth Colony, right? You have this meeting house with a man's head and a bloody flag. That was what one would see if they arrived at Plymouth in 1630, but that's not what I had imagined I would see if I arrived in Plymouth in 1630. So I don't know what to do with that particular kind of violence. I will say that even their pastor, Pastor Robinson, who was back in Holland, when William Bradford wrote to Pastor Robinson and said, here's how we're doing in Plymouth, and here's this attack that we did, a little boastfully, actually. Pastor Robinson says, but if you could have converted some of them, which you might anticipate, but then he also says, basically, you should be cautious, and you probably shouldn't have done that. And he says, where there was first bloodshed, there will be more. And so the religious advisors were saying, you're getting a little too violent. What are you doing? But there was.
So was that actually a challenge, though, for you as a writer about how to write about that violence and how Native Americans, how to write about them when you consider how they were written about and how they're still portrayed in history books? You know, was that a challenge for you to write that aspect of us?
Yeah. Once I was working from all of these gaps and I started filling in the gaps, and some gaps I was much more comfortable moving into, like the gap of the woman who perishes when off the moored Mayflower. But then when I was thinking about the gaps of how they were treating the Wampanoag Indians, I worked with a couple different people, including a knowledge holder and a member of the Wampanoag Nation. And I showed her the draft of the book as I had it and then got her feedback and made changes. I felt like, and what I learned so much from her. And part of what I learned from her is, there will be all of this archive telling you one thing, and then what doesn't get put into that archive or verified are all of these oral histories, all of these alternative versions of something. So I knew that I didn't want to say, I knew that I wanted to move into a space of critique, and I felt both potentially from like people whose ancestors were on the Mayflower, I felt this sense of I want to do justice as much as I can. This isn't solely a criticism. And then from the other perspective, I knew that I needed to show where that violence was and to humanize as much as I could.
Tarashe Nesbitt, it was great to have you join us for the Radio Book Club, your latest novel, Beheld. As we always do at the end of each episode, we invite listeners to read along with the next book. And for May, in fact, Arsene, we have several books to talk about because we've got some bonus editions coming up.
Well, I'll give you the May books. So we're going to do two shows in May. The first will be with Elizabeth Gilbert for her book City Girls, which is a novel. Of course, Elizabeth Gilbert writes both novels and nonfiction. Eat, Pray, Love is her most famous book. This is a book about 1940s New York theater, and it's being told by a woman who's 89 and looking back on her life from a span of almost 70 years about what life was like when she was a late teenager, 20 in her 20s in the New York theater world. So that's City of Girls. And then in our usual spot, the fourth Thursday in May, we'll be talking to Mira Jacob for her book, Good Talk. And this is going to be the first graphic novel that we've ever had on the show. And I love this book. This is a book that I had in my best of 2019 list. And Mira uses the book to get into racism, and it's through conversations with her son, and really does a beautiful job of talking about kind of touchy subjects in a way that, you know, the whole family can relate to.
Well, lots of bonus content to look forward to, some bumper editions, extra editions of the Radio Book Club coming your way for May and June. We'll put the details at our website, news.kgnu.org. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast of the Radio Book Club. You can listen again, listen anytime. And of course, you get extra material because we have our podcast only edition after hours at the Radio Book Club. Well, I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. Our guest today has been author Tairse Nesbitt, and we've been reading her latest novel, Beheld, a return for Tairse to the Radio Book Club. And as always, my co-host is Arsen Keshkashian of the Boulder Bookstore. Thank you both so much.
Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure. I'm happy to be back and to have been one of your first. It's always a delight.